This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cunnan in Washington. Every year we take time to remember those we've lost over the past 12 months and focus on those whose obituaries may not have made the front page, yet whose accomplishments and lives should still be remembered. We've asked a few of our NPR colleagues and friends to join us. We also want to hear from you. If there's somebody you knew or knew of who died in 2011 you think we should remember, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. We got this email from Hilmer, who suggested Barbara Kent, who co-starred with Greta Garbo and John Gilbert in Flesh and the Devil, died at 103. There are not many actors left who appeared in silent films. And let's go to a caller. James is on the line. James with us from St. Louis.
Yes, hello. I feel like we should really remember the young adult author, Brian Jakes, who through the 80s and 90s wrote the children's series Redwall, who put the genre on the map before even the Harry Potter books.
So he wrote of wizards and witches?
Actually, he wrote of warrior mice and otters and little evil rats and ferrets.
He was a little bit out of my range as a young adult, so I have to say I'm not familiar with his work.
He was an older writer. He actually was from Liverpool, England, and he wrote the stories originally for an institute of blind children. So they were, you know, he was a radio host for the BBC and felt that this was a group of kids that were kind of neglected at the time, and his books ended up really becoming loved by millions.
James, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Bye.
NPR's Netta Ulaby joins us here in Studio 3A. She covers arts, entertainment, and cultural trends for NPR. Many will reflect on the lives of artists like Amy Winehouse today. Netta remembers musician Mariana Joan Elliott Said, better known by her stage name Polly Styrene, who made hits like Good Time Girl.
I don't want to be.
And Netta Ulaby is with us here in Studio 3A. Polly Styrene, with a name like that, I suspect convention was not her strong suit.
Anti-establishmentarianism was her strong suit. She called herself Polly Styrene because she said, it's plastic, it's disposable, that's what pop stars are meant to be, and I thought I might as well send it up. And sending up expectations and what a pop star was supposed to be, what a woman was supposed to be, and what a punk rocker was supposed to be was what she did, and she did it very well for 53 years.
I was going to say, disposable, that's a long career.
Well, you know, I wish it had been longer. She started, though, when she was just a teenager. She went and saw the Sex Pistols when she was 18 years old, decided to start her own punk band, and you know, she was almost the opposite of how you might imagine a punk rocker in Britain in the 1970s. You know, you might imagine like a skinny white guy wearing bondage gear with really bad attitude and teeth to match. She was half Somali, half English. Chubby. She liked to wear bright day-glow jumpsuits that she would often make herself, and she wore braces.
And we should note that, yes, a long career, but died just as her new album, Generation Indigo, was being released. And, well, her sound also changed over time.
It did. Well, you can call me a dot of the girl with a heart, but I would say I'm just a little bit smart. And I don't care what they say, I'm kitsch all the way. I'm just a little bit kitsch, yeah, a little bit kitsch. I got my head in the clouds, but my feet on the ground. I'm just a little bit kitsch, yeah, a little bit kitsch.
A little bit kitsch.
Consumer culture was one of the things that she would take on in her music. And in that album, she wrote about a lot of things that were important to her: veganism, spirituality. She had a crazy life. After she started this band, the X-Ray Specs, which was really an important early punk band, the band broke up. She became a Hare Krishna. She battled terrible mental illness for much of her life, and she got run over by a fire truck.
No.
Yeah, and she released 3 solo albums. That was the last one, and it came out the day after she died.
Wow. So Polly Styrene, does she leave a legacy?
She absolutely does. And, you know, I love all of her albums. Well, not all of her albums. Definitely that one, the most recent one. Robert Christgau, in his NPR review, said that she always says what she means plainly, winningly, and tunefully. And on Generation Indigo, that album, those meanings are moral. And the legacy she leaves, she helped influence the Riot Girls. I think one of Catherine Hanna is one of the Kathleen Hanna is one of the founders of Bikini Kill, and she said that she doesn't know a single musician who wasn't inspired by polystyrene.
Thank you very much, Netta. Appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you.
And happy Boxing Day.
Thanks.
NPR Arts and Entertainment reporter Netta Ulibi, kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. And again, we'd like to hear your suggestions on those we ought to remember who died this past year. 800-989-8255. Email talk at npr.org. Let's go back to the phones. Mark is on the line with us from Jackson, Wyoming.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I would like to see if everyone could remember Norma Zimmer from the Lawrence Welk Show. She passed away in May of this year, and I believe that she should be remembered. She was just such a nice, wholesome person who had a lasting impact on lots of people for many years. She was the champagne lady on the Lawrence Welk Show.
The champagne, I remember well enough to go a one and a two. What did the champagne lady do?
Well, she was a featured singer on the Lawrence Welk program for many years. I just remember watching the Lawrence Welk Show when I was a child, and you know, like you and so many others, you tend to forget a lot of these things. And then years ago, I was living in New York City, Utah, and ran into her son, and it was to her home and meet her and her husband, hang out with them for a few hours on her birthday. And that was quite a lovely experience to be able to see someone like that in person and be hosted in her home and just see what a nice, normal, down-to-earth person she was.
Well, Mark, thanks very much for the story. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet.
Let's go next to, this is Pam. Pam with us from San Diego.
Hello there. I was calling to remember Sister Rosemary Lentz, who died after being hit by a car at the age of 93, and that was just about a year ago on January 9th. And Rosemary was the co-founder of the faith-based resistance to nuclear weapons testing at the Nevada test site, and also worked to form a Franciscan Pache Ebene, which was a service in nonviolence and cultural resistance. Rosemary was, she brought peace by living peace. She was a spiritual resource to we demonstrators, but also to the test site workers and to the law enforcement officers, who anyone who met her just fell in love with her, and she lived a life in the spirit of St. Francis.
Well, Pam, thanks. Did you know her personally?
Yes, I did. I did. And you could call her up any time, and it was just like she had been waiting for your phone call.
Pam, thanks very much. Let's go next to, this is Charlotte. Charlotte calling us from Tucson.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thanks. I wanted to remember Gabe Zimmerman, who was the aide who was killed in the shootings in Tucson.
Oh, yes.
In January. He was a personal friend of mine, as well as just an incredible, incredible person. He could take an angry constituent and turn him around in about 5 minutes, and they'd be friends for life.
We had Mark Kelly on the show, I think, a couple of weeks ago. And obviously, Gabe figures in the book that Mark and, of course, Gabby wrote about her life and their lives together.
Yeah, I haven't picked it up yet, but I'm looking forward to reading it.
What about him most impressed you?
He could keep his cool in any situation. He was just so professional. I worked with him through a local solar company for a few years, and we became friends. And it was just amazing to watch him work. He was obviously born to work with people. So,
well, Charlotte,
it's a shame.
Yes,
miss him every day.
I think we can all agree on that, Charlotte. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Much too young, Gabe Zimmerman. Let's go next to, this is Terry. Terry with us from Montrose in Colorado.
Hello. Yes, my father, Edward Pauls, invented the Nordic track and just passed away in October. He also invented the Alpine ski boot and binding system called the Rosemont binding, and also the flip ski outrigger for disabled Alpine skiers.
Now, I'd heard a story, I remember an obit of your father when he passed away about the invention of the Nordic track because he was so frustrated by other devices.
Well, actually, he was frustrated by running on dark and icy streets in Minnesota at about 5 o'clock when it would get dark in the fall and winter. So he originally invented it for his own purpose, to train for a local ski race. But then he got laid off for a second time and needed to make some money, and a friend suggested that he actually sell it.
And did it do well immediately?
Well, it doubled every year, which is the type of growth most small business owners would kill for. So it was very successful, but it, when something is small, it continues to be small for a while, even while it's doubling. So it wasn't until about 1984 that people who I would just meet on the street would actually recognize the name Nordic Track. But it obviously became quite popular and successful. But the thing that impressed me about my dad is that although he had that success, he was never a workaholic. He always prioritized the family. And so we did a lot of fun outdoor activities together. But there's one particular story that demonstrates his character. When I was 37, he sent me a pogo stick. And inside he had written the instructions for it and also said that he was successful at using his pogo stick. And that my brother had one, and his grandson had one. And at the end, he said, "Keep the kid in you alive."
That sounds like good advice for us all. Keep the kid in you alive. Terry, yeah. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Clarence Clemons, who played sax in Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, died in June of this year. He was known as one of rock's most beloved sidemen for his friendly onstage presence and his soaring sax. This is Lights of the City, Clarence Clemons with Springsteen and the E Street Band. More in a minute. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. We're remembering some of the remarkable people who died this past year, like Harry Coover Jr. NPR's Amy Blazik remembered him for our website. Coover stumbled upon a miraculous substance while working to create clear plastic gun sights for military firearms. The stuff stuck to everything. Years later, what we now call superglue hit the market. Coover was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame, and in 2010, President Obama awarded him the National Medal of Technology and Innovation. If there's somebody you knew or knew of who died in 2011 you think we ought to remember, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. The Arab Spring dominated headlines this year. Many died across the Arab world during armed battles, protests, and riots. One Libyan citizen journalist who lost his life was Mohammed Nabous, who lived in a live stream channel to update the world about what was happening in Libya.
If you can hear me, hello. He is probably Benghazi, no doubt. I have seen it myself with my own eyes. Right now, I was in an area called Hayy Dular, a Dular area. And he has bombed it. He has bombed the area, over the area, has no, even a camp, nothing. I can't talk much. I'm waiting for the battery to charge. And then I'm going to go live with you. I mean, this is just not good anymore. He has to be stopped. I mean, I just don't know how to...
From Mohammed Nabous's last live stream broadcast, we apologize for the poor audio quality. Andy Carvin is with us. He manages social media for NPR and followed Mohammed Nabous's updates before his death and joins us now from his home in Maryland. Andy, good of you to be with us.
Thanks, Neil.
And in some ways, you say Mohammed Nabous embodied the ideals of citizen journalism.
Well, in many ways, he was the first true journalist to come out of Libya in over a generation. He didn't have a journalism background. He was a technologist by training, but he also knew how to install satellite dishes. And so when the revolution started and became a full-blown civil war, he managed to set up a satellite connection. And using a live streaming system, he started broadcasting to the world, telling people what was going on. And he quickly developed a reputation as being one of the best sources for information as to what was going on, even before Western reporters got inside the country.
An advocate or a reporter?
In his case, he was both. He focused really hard on getting factual information out as best he could, and you could see him struggle with it live sometimes when he'd get contradictory information. But at the same time, he was a civilian. He was literally in the crosshairs. He knew that his city was about to be bombed, and he wanted to make sure that he could document what was going on. And so if there was any question about a ceasefire violation, the world would know about it. And ultimately, he ended up dying several hours before the NATO bombing raids started, as he went out one last time to try to document the ceasefire violation.
Did he know that that intervention was the turning point of the Libyan uprising? From that moment on, NATO intervention weighed heavily on the side of the rebels. Perhaps the outcome was inevitable from that point on, but was he aware that that turning point had started?
He was aware that something was happening because the UN Security Council had already voted at that point. And if you listen to some of the final videos, you can actually hear him essentially cursing the UN Security Council for not taking action faster. Like, what more evidence do you need? I'm out here, I'm showing footage of bloody pillows and holes through people's homes. What else do you need? And he was dead a couple hours after that, and several hours later, the bomb started to fall from NATO.
And the first real journalist out of Libya in, what, the 40 years that Muammar Gaddafi was in control there, because it was not until there was a safe zone where rebel forces were in command in the eastern part of the country, in and around Benghazi, that people could afford to work. And obviously that was risky in and of itself.
And that's precisely what happened. As soon as Benghazi was taken over by the rebels, he was able to set up and maintain a single satellite connection near the Benghazi courthouse. And volunteers would even try to protect him to make sure that no one could come near the entrance of the building, because it was so important that they kept that single feed going. And that ended up becoming the Libya Al-Hurra TV, as they called it, or essentially free TV, free Libya TV. And for exactly 1 month, from February 19th to March 19th, he brought cast that way every day until he died on the morning of March 19th.
Andy Carbon, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Neil.
NPR social media strategist Andy Carbon remembering Mohammed Nabous, a citizen journalist who died in Libya earlier this year. If you find remembrances written by our colleagues across NPR and contribute your own if you'd like, at our website, go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Let's go next to Laura, and Laura's on the line from Pittsburgh.
Hi, I just wanted to remember my grandpa, Jack Carmody. He's from Indianapolis. He was a World War II veteran, and one really interesting story about when he was serving was that he was named mayor of a small town in Germany. He was one of the few soldiers who spoke German, so he was able to do that. And he made sure to give a proper burial to, like, all the victims of, like, some of the, you know, terrible acts that occurred there. And the thing that I really love about him is, although he saw so many terrible things happen in World War II and how inhumane some people can be, it just encouraged him to be even more loving and care about people even more. And he's never bitter about it, or he never was bitter about it. So he's a really awesome guy.
What did he do after the war?
After the war, he was a dentist in Indianapolis, and pretty much everyone that I've, like, so many people that I talk to when I'm visiting know him and just say, like, what a great person he is. And you just hear the same thing from every person, that he was just so friendly and, you know.
Thanks very much for the call, Laura. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Here's an email from Randall in Mountain View, California. I'd like to remember the life of Dennis Ritchie, a noteworthy member of the 20th century computer science community. Mr. Ritchie was instrumental in the development of the Unix operating system that's still a key element of the World Wide Web, cloud computing, and every Macintosh made in the past decade or so. He was also the inventor of the C programming language, which was used in Unix, Linux, Microsoft Windows, and an enormous range of other software for the past 30-plus years. Let's go next to Ray, and Ray's with us from San Ybel in Florida. Ray, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just read this weekend that Lynn Samuels, the New York City radio talk show host, probably people in the country don't know her, but if anybody lived in or around New York City, she was the epitome of a New Yorker, loud and just a wonderful lady. She was on, I guess, WABC for many years, and she was host of WBAI, which was a left-wing radio station in New York back in the 70s, and it's just sad to see her go. I live in Florida now, so I haven't heard her in maybe 10 or 15 years, so that's who I just want. I just noticed she died a couple days ago.
I knew Lynn to say hi to. I'm sorry to hear she's passed away. Thanks very much for the call, Ray.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Point of personal privilege, Dave Cray, producer of All Things Considered. When I arrived at National Public Radio back in 1977, 1978, Dave Cray died this past month, too. We'd like to remember him for his work at KLON and WJHU as well. Let's see if we go next to, this is Doug. Doug with us from Boise.
Yes, hi. I'd like to remember my mother-in-law, Helen Torbicalson, who passed away this year. She touched many children's lives as a junior high counselor in a tough suburb of Denver, and then went on to spend many years helping children as part of CASA, which is court-appointed special advocates.
Court-appointed special advocates?
Yep, it's an organization in Denver that helped children who were kind of gotten into the court system and needed help.
Why did she care so much about it?
You know, she just had a great love for children. You know, it's just, she just, it's just beyond anything you've ever seen before. She, her willingness to give anything that she could to help these children find a better life was just unbelievable. And she's not internationally or nationally known, but she's kind of a hero around Denver. And a hero in our family.
Of course. Thanks very much for the call. This is an email from Sevi. This is an email from Dina in Berkeley, California. This is a personal one, but my 54-year-old brother died on December 12th. He was an inspirational middle school science teacher who influenced many of his former students to become scientists. That makes him worthy of remembering. And his name was Rick Watson, and he lived in Placerville in California. NPR's Sonari Glinton is with us. He's a reporter who focuses on the auto industry, and he joins us to remember Esther Gordy Edwards, an influential figure in Motown. He joins us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Sonari, nice to have you with us today.
It's good to be here.
And people usually attribute the founding of Motown with Esther's younger brother, Barry Gordy, but I gather she played an important role, too.
Yeah, I like to think of it in this way, that in the beginning of Motown, Esther Gordy was the business and Barry Gordy was the show. So she did about everything that you could think of behind the scenes. She helped run the business. She did the books. She ran the talent agency. And she's sort of responsible for this idea of getting the performers into charm school and dance classes,
uh-huh.
and making sure that they were really polished when they went out on the stage.
So that choreography that we associate with the Miracles and the Temptations, she was in some way responsible for that.
Yeah, she wanted Motown performers to not only be representatives of Motown, the organization, but Detroit, the city, and for Black people in general, that they should have the sophisticated that they should be sophisticated representatives of the community. And she was an incredibly sophisticated woman.
Motown, of course, relocated from Detroit to Los Angeles. Did Esther Gordy go along?
No, she didn't. She stayed in Detroit, and she was really, really sort of involved in the life of Detroit. But the big thing she did in Detroit was she looked at all the dreck that people things that people thought were dreck, the leftovers, the old costumes, the, you know, old drum kits. And she said, you know what, this is going to be meaningful in the future. And she was collecting this stuff as, you know, during the course of the years. And she started in 1985 the Hitsville USA Museum, the Motown Museum. That is, you know, I can't imagine Detroit without, you know, being able to go down Grand Avenue and look at the building and see, like, man, that is where it all started. And that was her idea. She helped bring the company about, and she helped cement his legacy by giving us a place to look at to see where all this great music was created.
And inevitably, as time goes on, the Motown memory will never be in Los Angeles.
No. There's nothing L.A. about Motown except the headquarters.
Except the headquarters. Maybe some of the bank accounts.
Yeah, that too.
And what did she do these last several years?
Well, she was really involved in encouraging women to get involved in the civic life of the city. So she was on several boards, including she was on Detroit's Recorder of Deeds board. Her husband was a state rep. So she was always sort of in the social life of Detroit. And she was a really big booster and preservationist. I mean, in the worst of, you know, times, in 1985, it was probably as bad as it could get for Detroit until later.
Until later.
She was opening this museum, and you know, she was 91 when she passed away in August, but she was really so important to the life of the city and of Motown and this incredible Gordy family. That, you know, we think of Berry Gordy as just the beginning, and you're like, something Gordy was going to happen. You know, they come from a really, really rich, rich in wealth, but also in sort of entrepreneurial spirit family. And you knew that something was going to come out of this family. And it happened to be probably the greatest music label of the 20th century.
Sonari Glinton, thanks very much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Sonari Glinton joined us from member station WBEZ in Chicago to remember Esther Gordy Edwards. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. An email from Rhea in Portland, Oregon. I want to remember Lynn Margulis, one of the original creators of the Gaia hypothesis with James Lovelock. She was an amazing biologist, and her writings will continue to inspire us towards seeing the Earth as alive. Also, James Hillman, one of the founders of Depth Psychology, a pioneer in the work of listening to the soul and recognizing the need not to heal our problems, but to understand them as part of our essential neighbor. Essential nature, excuse me. Let's see if we go next to, this is Joan. Joan with us from San Francisco.
Hi, I wanted to talk about Warren Hellman. He was a billionaire financial man who gave so generously to our city and the whole area. He was on the board of the San Francisco Foundation for a long period of time, but most important, probably to the people in this area, is he founded and supported completely the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival, which happens here every September. He was a banjo player, and this is one way to get a venue for your band, obviously, but it was way more than that for Warren Hellman. He was a runner. He completed the Western States 100-mile endurance run, and his name is just really well-known in this area. He and his wife donated generously to the San Francisco Ballet, so he's all over the arts and environment and all of the good things, and he'll be sorely missed.
I remember seeing his picture in the paper, yes, the philanthropist sitting there with a banjo.
Exactly. I think just before he died, and I didn't know, and very few people probably did, that he had leukemia that he was battling for quite a while. But he was sitting there with his banjo, and he did a recording, actually, that's probably available now. But he was an amazing man, you know, one of these rare people in the world. He was 74 years old. That's not very old these days.
Joan, thanks very much for the call. Email from Kara. I'll fondly remember Tom Keith, the longtime sound effects man for Minnesota Public Radio's A Prairie Home Companion. He gave many people the gift of laughter week after week. He had a skill that has become very rare, using just his voice to create realistic and hilarious sound effects from elk to helicopters to Bubbles, another one of our radio brethren who's gone away. Well, harking back to our conversation with Sonari Glinton about Esther Gordy, some Motown music to take you to the next break. Kid named Stevie Wonder, I think he might make it in this business. We'd like to hear your suggestions for people we should remember who died this past year. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'll blame it on the day that ended once too soon. I'll blame it on the nights that could not be. But my heart blames it on me. We're talking about the people we lost in 2011, the ones whose deaths may not have made a media splash, but who led remarkable lives all the same. Sandra Russell, one of our colleagues here at NPR, remembered her father, Harold, for our website. My dad was the managing partner of the Oklahoma City branch of the Big Eight accounting firm Arthur Young during the oil boom of the 1980s. Even though one of the largest sources of oil and gas loans, Penn Square Bank, was one of his most important clients, he refused to validate its less than sound methods of securing these loans, she writes. And when Penn Square Bank failed, she continues, he was vindicated for that particular tough call. If there's somebody you knew or knew of who died in 2011 you think we ought to remember, we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. This from Tom in Little Rock by email. The swashbuckling, brash, charismatic, throwback Spanish golfer Seve Ballesteros. In this age of cookie-cutter, academy-generated golfers, he was one of a kind, and win or lose, he was always a thrill to watch and to root for. Cliff Claremont is an award-winning comic book writer, and he joins us to remember the lives of two influential figures in that business who died this year, Joe Simon and Jerry Robinson. Chris joins us by phone from Reading, Connecticut. Chris, nice to talk to you. Welcome back to Talk to
Neil.
Nation.
Happy Christmas.
And happy Christmas to you, too. Certainly hard to lose not just one, but these were two of the towering figures.
Well, they're two of the foundation figures, absolutely. I mean, in Joe Simon's case, you've got the creator with Jack Kirby of Captain America. And I think one of the really apt things is that before his death, he got to see the character he created become a success on screen as well as in the comics. And, you know, the regret from my end is that he won't get a chance to see it all culminate in the Avengers next year, but that's a totally different story.
When we saw his obit published, we realized, of course, Captain America created for Timely Comics and featured Adolf Hitler on the first front cover.
Well, if you've got a bad guy, you might as well put him up there with your hero. And one has to say that Hitler was about as classic a villain as you could come get in any. By anybody's standards, and Pulp Fiction has lived off the Nazis for 70 years since then. But the other thing to bear in mind with Joe is that it wasn't just Captain America. I mean, in later years with DC, he created Sandman, which Neil Gaiman turned into a modern success back in the 90s, and Manhunter, which Walt Simonson and Archie Goodwin revolutionized back in the 80s.
Same thing, too, with Jerry Robinson. Yes, a contributor to the Golden Age, but a crucial figure in the Silver Age.
Yeah. I mean, the point was that none of these guys stayed in place. They did the work that they were paid to back in the day, but as time went on, they evolved with the time, and in Simon's case, went on to other things and came back to comics. Jerry was in a major figure in building an artist representation company, effectively agency. So they all they evolved as brilliant creators do. It's not staying in place and doing the same thing over and over and over again. And that's what keeps comics alive, and I think what keeps the work fresh.
Did you get a chance to work with them?
No. I mean, they were mostly DC guys by the time I came in.
Yes, mostly a Marvel guy.
Yeah.
And so they worked for Brand Ech, as they used to say.
Well, it's two sides of the table. You know, you've got the good guys on one side, the evil empire on the other. It just depends on which side you're affiliated with as to who gets tagged with the label. But as I said with Joe, the work he created inspired brilliant work by successive creators down the line. I mean, Neil's career was in part founded on the classic work he did with Sandman. And that grew out of Joe's original inspiration. Again, Archie and Walter's work on Manhunter, I read those books with a passion because they were reinterpreting this idea in a modern setting, much as writers have been doing with Captain America all along.
We'll find him frozen in one of those icebergs sooner or later.
Well, it's not so much that it's frozen in an iceberg, it's that each generation that comes along recreates them according to the... when you go back and look at Steve Englehart's work in the 70s, it was the Cap he was writing was a very passionate, occasionally left-wing sort of American patriot who was horrified by the excesses of the Nixon White House. So he found himself going down lines in the comic that put him against the establishment, and it was redefined again in the 80s and the 90s. So nothing stays in place, especially when you've got an icon as fundamental as Cap.
And just a couple of years ago, weighing in on the civil liberties debates of the Bush administration too. So
that too, but I think the important part was, you know, he was Cap reached out and gathered in a black colleague. So it was an expression of the rising racial consciousness of the time, and who knows how it led, you know, it might have helped in its own small, absurd way to the societal change or evolution that allowed for the election of a black president.
Joe Simon and Jerry Robinson both died this year. Great contributors to comics. Chris Claremont, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for asking me.
Chris Claremont, an award-winning comic book writer. He joined us from Reading, Connecticut. Let's see if we can get another caller in on the line. Let's go to Angie. Angie with us from Scott Hippo in West Virginia.
Yes, hi. I am calling because I wanted to remember a friend of mine whose name is Abby Kinney, and she was the founder of Homebirth Midwifery Service in Central Ohio. And Abby was among the pioneers of a midwifery credential called the Certified Professional Midwife. She held certificate number one, and she was known for her attention to detail, her organizational skill. I met and served with Abby as part of the leadership of the Midwives Alliance of North America, where I felt a bit intimidated by her despite my admiration. And I was fortunate enough to stay at her home in the spring of 2011, and she died in the fall of 2011. I remember her home being a sanctuary for her retirement, which she really never fully accomplished. And it was also home to a widowed swan who was very aggressive and chased her visitors around her pond and back into her house. And my personal memory, reflecting on her death, has been in the empowerment and birth of so many women who attribute their success in their major rite of passage to midwives like Abby, and how many midwives have been trained by Abby as well and have been inspired as midwives and professionals and community leaders in her community.
Thank you very much for the call, Angie.
Thank you.
Email from our colleague, Callie Crossley in Boston, who writes to remember Kip Tiernan of Boston, the founder of Rosie's Place, the first shelter for homeless women in the United States. Let's go next to, this is Christine. Christine calling from Portland.
Hi.
Hi, Christine. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was calling to remember Hazel Dickens. She was a pioneer in bluegrass and a pioneer for women in bluegrass and music. She died this past spring.
Hazel Dickens, I remember hearing an obituary broadcast on All Things Considered about her.
Yeah, yeah. She was definitely a unique figure. She was definitely, she sang about, you know, about real life in rural West Virginia. She sang about the non-union coal miners. She was kind of a reluctant feminist role model as well. And is still one of the only female role models in bluegrass music.
Reluctant feminist? How come?
I think she there was a quote when she sang some of her early songs that were about, you know, from a woman's perspective, which wasn't really anything that anyone was writing bluegrass music about. Some people had heard it and said, well, that's a nice song, but no one will ever sing it. And I think she felt that she wanted to stay away from being just kind of a novelty woman's act and really singing music that was, you know, important and about real people.
Christine, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
This from Rebecca in Tacoma Park, Maryland. I'd like to remember my friend and neighbor, Gary Kettler. Gary passed away on Christmas Eve from brain cancer. If you could say one thing about Gary, beside the fact that he was a devoted husband and loving father, it would be that he loved to keep up with current events. He was an avid reader of The New Yorker and any newspaper he could get his hands on, other than USA Today, except when on vacation, and it was the only thing he could find. We will all miss him terribly. And this from Sherry, who emailed us to say, I would like to remember visionary artist Robert Venosa. I got the honor of knowing Robert as a member of my community in Boulder and beyond. Robert was not only an amazing artist, but a true seeker of wisdom and a stellar example of an evolutionary being. We're remembering lives lost in 2011. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we go next to Scott. And Scott is with us from Detroit.
Hi, I'm calling today to remember David Blair. David Blair was a poet and an urban folk musician. And I had the pleasure of being a member of the Detroit Poetry Slam team the year we won the National Poetry Slam. And the way David could move an audience was just unbelievable. And the way he could make people feel comfortable to express themselves was also priceless. He toured the United States extensively in Europe as well and touched a lot of people I know, and we all miss him here.
Do you happen to remember any of his lines?
No, I don't. I barely can remember my own lines 12 years later after winning. So I do know that he did a piece about learning opera when he was a young child, when he was a four-year-old, that we used to close the final night that clinched the victory, and he literally had people crying in the audience in a very moving piece, and he had that power of just moving people. It was remarkable. So,
thanks, Scott, for the call. Appreciate it.
Yeah, bye.
Let's go next to, this is Katie. Katie with us from St. Augustine.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Katie.
Great. I wanted to remember Stetson Kennedy.
Of course.
I had the privilege of seeing Stetson speak several times. He spent his last how many years in St. Augustine, and he was such a just inspiring humanitarian and human rights advocate. I think most well known for his infiltration of the KKK during the 60s.
Mm-hmm. He was awfully well. What was it like to listen to him speak?
Oh, it was amazing. He was just a really, I don't know the word, just really funny and down-to-earth guy. The times that I saw him, he was well into his 90s and pretty hard of hearing. So his wife was always there to let him know what the audience's questions were. But he was always just a pleasure to see. I always loved to know that he was close friends with Marjorie Keenan Rawlings and Zora Neale Hurston, who are some of my favorite writers. And the last, one of the really cool things I thought that he did when the Florida minister was planning to burn Qurans maybe last year, Stetson pledged to go and perform a citizen's arrest on him because he, you know, of course, didn't think that was right. So he was just an inspiration, a really, really cool guy to get to see walking around town and to hear speak.
Thanks very much, Katie.
Thank you.
This email from Christina. I'd like to remember my mother-in-law, Betty Roberts, who passed away this year. She was the first woman to run for Oregon governor, the second to run for the Senate, and the first woman on our state's Court of Appeals and the first woman on our Supreme Court. She was the recipient of many, many awards, not the least of which was the ABA's Margaret Brett Award and an honorary doctorate from Portland State University. Let's go next to Linda, and Linda is with us from Southern Illinois.
Hi. It's so good to talk to you.
Thank you.
In the last 6 years, I've lost both my parents. I've lost lots of aunts and uncles, but we lost our oldest cousin in our generation, Phil Stout. Phil Stout of Indianapolis, who was born in Wabash County, Indiana. He was an elementary education. He was an elementary school teacher and a substitute teacher, and he taught for a while in Kuwait. He was a monster walker. He set a 2,000-mile walking record at the Indianapolis 500 Speedway.
Just walking around and around the oval?
That's correct. And he did Volks marches all the time. I walked with him sometimes.
Hard to keep up with somebody like
that. We visited. That's correct. And he race walked, you know, the formal race walking gets you there faster.
It does. Linda, thank you so much.
Well, he was a dedicated and loyal son to his parents. His mother just died at the age of 97, 2.5 years ago. He was a point man for both of his parents in their advanced age.
Dedication we should also remember. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Let's get one last email. This is from Sarah in Madison, Wisconsin. My brother Andy Nelson was 59 when he died, October 23rd in Springfield, Illinois. He lived in a group situation with other developmentally disabled men. His 8 siblings miss his deep and joyous laughter and keen social observations. He continued his helpful spirit in unexpected ways through giving organ donations. His corneas, muscle tissue, bone, and beautiful unwrinkled skin will extend the quality of life for countless others. Thank you. We'd also like to remember Charles Kaupu, the Hawaiian chanter who died this time last summer. Thank you to all of you who wrote and emailed us and contributed on our website to remember those who we lost in 2011. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.